everyone, my name is Klaatu, and this is Episode X of Season X of the GNU World Order. Today, we are going to talk about a lot of really exciting things. We're going to build our own environment, which isn't quite as exciting as it sounds, but it is exciting in many ways. We're going to do a demo of MyPaint. I even have the Wacom tablet ready to go. And we've got, we're going to talk about GIMP layering for the noobs. And lots of other stuff. So let's start, as usual, with the fortune of the show. Which today looks like it's from Ralph Waldo Emerson. So, let us treat men and women well. Treat them as if they were real. Perhaps they are. That's a good one. I like that one. And now, of course, the Emacs tip of the day. This is just, again, some pretty quick little tips about inserting text and some little features about Emacs that you might not really know about, but now you will because you're going to see it in action. I'm going to open up a file with Control X, Control F, and I'm going to type in compose because that's the compose file that I keep around because I can never remember what fancy symbols I'm supposed to use half the time. So I just want to kind of go over some really basic things, one of which is selecting. So in the GUI mode of Emacs, you can select big blocks of text with just hitting the shift key and the up or down arrow, or the shift key and then control in or P. So that's, you know, control shift in, control shift P, and then you're selecting big blocks of text. Now from there you can do whatever you want. You can copy, you can cut, paste, clear, whatever you want to do. Or you can do all of that with Alt X as well. You know, if you want to delete region, you can do that. However you want to do it. Now that I've messed up this file, of course, I would want to make sure that I don't accidentally save over it, so I'm going to save as. That's kind of an important concept in editing, as you probably know. And again, in the GUI context, there's saving and saving as just in your file menu, but if you're not in the GUI, you can do Control X, Control W, and that writes the file to some other thing. So I'm going to call this delete me so that I remember later to delete it, and now I've got a clean new file that I can screw up in my demonstration. So back to selecting for a moment. So we saw in the GUI that we could do shift up and down, or shift control P and N, or even, I mean, heck, it doesn't have to be that. It can be control shift F or control shift B, or right arrow, shift right or left arrow, if you want to just select words like that, or regions of words, whatever. So that's simple. In outside of a GUI, you can do the same thing, but it's sort of, it's called marking in and marking marking in and marking out, I guess, or something. And it's usually, it is rather, control space. And then you go to where you want to end your selection or whatever, and then you do your action, and now you have it selected. So that's kind of handy. To get out of a selection, it's control G. If you want to get out of a selection without doing any action, you decide you didn't want to select that, it's control G. Control G is the universal panic button of Emacs. You can always hit control G to sort of back out of whatever you've gotten yourself into. So that's selecting. Saving as again was control X and then control W. And saving, of course, is just control X, control S. So if I'd selected a bunch of stuff, and then I did Alt X delete region, then I could say that maybe I wanted to, I can't remember, there we go. Now I want to save it, so I'll do a control X and then S, and that saves it to whatever current buffer you're visiting, whatever current file you're visiting. That is saving, selecting, and saving. Okay, so those are handy little commands to know for Emacs. So building your own environment, that's what I'm calling this discussion. And if you look at the Linux experience, you can see it in a lot of different ways.
And one of the ways that you can look at it is it's open source software, it's free, it's something that you download and you use, and isn't it cool that someone built that? And it is, and that's a valid way of looking at it, I think. That's a really great thing to take note of and to appreciate, and that certainly doesn't diminish the Linux experience at all. And for some people, that is the Linux experience. Another way to look at it, though, is that it can be something of your own creation. You can kind of like, you can design your own Linux experience. I mean, integration, don't get me wrong, integration, total integration is really, really cool. And luckily, Linux is flexible enough that you can make everything integrated, but it doesn't have to be predetermined, is what I'm saying. So traditionally, very traditionally, and philosophically, the Unix way is to string stuff together. That is one of the core tenets of Unix. It is generally even called part of the Unix philosophy. And the thing about stringing stuff together is, you know, I mean, you can take things that were created by completely different people, possibly for completely different purposes, and you can stick them together, and suddenly you'll have something new. You'll have something that you're at the very least, you're killing two birds with one stone, right? Because you've kind of connected these two things, and now you can take some action by executing one command or one thing, and suddenly you're doing more than just one thing. In a GUI environment, that doesn't exactly work the same way. On the command line, it works exactly as that. But in the GUI environment, it doesn't necessarily work that way. But you can still kind of cobble something together for yourself. And if you look at it a certain way, you can say, yeah, that's my desktop. That's my desktop environment that I just built for myself. And that's a lot of fun. So if you're the type of person who likes to tinker with stuff and kind of design your own, design your own stuff, and really feel like you're building your own computer interface, as it were, this could really, really be a lot of fun for you. And you can make it be whatever you want it to be, really. I mean, it's very, very flexible. You can make something beautiful, or you can make something beautifully ugly. Let's explore all of the options right now.
I don't want to make this a Fluxbox tutorial, but we are going to start with Fluxbox because it is very, very configurable. And, you know, there are worse things in the world than Fluxbox tutorials. So this is the default, pretty much, Flux screen, which is, you know, empty space with a taskbar down at the bottom. And it's a taskbar, it's got workspace switchers, the traditional kind of taskbar thing, and then on the very far right-hand corner, a clock, which sits, actually, it's a clock in a system tray, and we can confirm this by launching something that would traditionally go into the system tray, like KMix. If we had a different mixer, we could use that instead, but I have KMix on here, so I'll just use that for now. And it's, of course, starting all the KDE dependencies, and getting there. And finally, yes, you can see down in the bottom right corner, there's a little audio mixer icon, and if I click it, it brings up the mixer application. So that bar is configurable, sure. Like, we could right-click on the desktop and go down to our Fluxbox menu and go to the configure toolbar submenu, and we could turn it off by making it not visible, but we can also say, for instance, place it on the top center instead of the bottom center, which is where bottom left or whatever, wherever it is right now. We can modify its alpha value so it's a little bit transparent. I don't think I have a compositor installed on here for Fluxbox, so that wouldn't work, but you could do it if you wanted. But what if we didn't want to use that one? Well, that is something that we can opt out of. But in order for that to work completely, I have to restart Fluxbox, and I can't record that because obviously restarting Fluxbox actually is not that big of a deal. I can go to Fluxbox, I can restart, and that was a restart, but it maintained all of the settings. And what I need it to do is to make the toolbar go away. I don't want that particular toolbar, so I've hidden that. That'll work. So I'm gonna log out of Fluxbox and then log back in, and I'll be right back. Okay, here we are. We're back in Fluxbox. This time we have no system tray active whatsoever. So we can use a different one, and there's a couple of different ones that we could use. For this moment, I'm going to use something called PEK SysTray, P-E-K SysTray. Let's make this bigger. Try that again. Okay. So yeah, we'll do PEK SysTray. We'll do the display should default to where we are right now. So I'll say icon size. We'll do, let's try 32. No, let's try, I don't know, 16. And then we'll do a width. This is for the actual system tray itself. And the height, we'll do 64 as well. So it's going to be a little cube. And I'll start it with the ampersand in the background. So now you can see kind of after I launched it, it pushed my window away from the edge. And that's because this little white block down in the bottom right corner, right there, you can see it if I move something in front behind it. That's the system tray, and right now it's empty. But once again, we can do something like kmix, and that'll start all the KDE dependencies again. And you might be able to tell. Again, it's kind of hard to see because it's small, and I don't have any kind of screen magnifier for Fluxbox installed. But there's a little system. There's a little rather 16 pixel mixing icon down there in the system tray now. And we could continue this with, for instance, Clipper, which is the clipboard application. We could do Wicked GTK, which would take care of networking for us. And that's all down there in the little bottom right corner, sort of sitting pretty. So that's an option. My point being that even the system tray, which traditionally is just kind of a part of the task manager, you know, it's just kind of something that appears in the bar, that's actually a self, there's a specification, a free desktop specification for that. And so other applications can tap into that. Another cool one to know about is called Tint 2, with the ampersand. And we should see a little taskbar here at the bottom of our screen. Now this is technically problematic because I'm already running PEK SysTray, and so Tint 2 is kind of it can't grab control of the SysTray, so there's a little bit of a conflict there. That's okay. I don't need that. I just wanted to show you that Tint 2 exists. And the configuration file for Tint 2, let me make this large, lives in your home folder in config tint2 and then tint2rc. And obviously it's not going to exist if you haven't launched it yet, but otherwise it'll be there. And you can do all kinds of things with that. So you can modify the color. So let's say 1 red, 5 green, and lots of blue. And rounded 7, that looks a little bit harsh to me, so let's round it by 4 pixels instead. You can kind of look through the configuration and kind of get a feeling for just how many there are. I mean, there's a lot to play with here. You can do all kinds of things. You can position it at different places, so instead of the bottom, let's move it to the top where these types of things belong. And center, let's do the left. Let's start at the left for no good reason. But then that border is going to look weird, or the roundedness is going to look weird, so we'll just say 0 roundedness. Top left horizontal, we'll make it maybe 75% of the screen. Panel dock, I don't know what that means. Let's turn it on and see. Window manager menu, don't know what that means. Lots of different options. So now we'll have to kill all Tint 2, and then we'll restart it, and again, it's going to complain about the system tray. I guess we could try. Let's try this. Let's kill all PEK SysTray. I don't believe that relinquishes control of the system tray. I could be wrong, but now we'll launch Tint 2, and it started not at the top, so I must have gotten the keyword for that incorrect. But it did actually give me my little icon that I wanted for Space FM, so that's nice. And it still is acting, obviously, as a system tray, which is kind of nice. I mean, a task manager. And it did actually get my system tray, it looks like. So that's pretty cool. So yeah, the point, again, being modularity. You could obviously have all of this stuff by default with something else, but it might not be as configurable. Tint 2 is, I mean, if you know a little bit of, not CSS, but if your mind deals well with things like CSS, then Tint 2, you can really just kind of go all over with it. It's really a powerfully configurable little menu bar that you can do really anything with. I mean, you know, insofar as making it your system tray and designing it differently, you've got complete control over that. So that's kind of nice. But again, that's not actually the only one that you could use. There should be an XFCE4 panel installed or installable on your system. And if you start that, then it will actually launch without the rest of the XFCE desktop. I mean, it brings a lot of the XFCE stuff into, you know, along with it, just like launching something from KDE launches a bunch of KDE-specific services. So it's not quite as modular as, say, Tint 2, which just doesn't even care. It's just using free desktop specs. But it is kind of cool, because you get your little your menu. There's missing icons, but that's easy to fix. It's just a matter of configuring where GTK is looking for icons, so that's actually not that big of a deal. I think I cover that in a different episode. But yeah, you've got all the sort of the conveniences of the XFCE desktop without necessarily having any kind of constraint about what you can do, you know, outside of the XFCE desktop, because you're not actually using the XFCE desktop. This is just the XFCE panel. So that's kind of cool. Those are the possibilities, and they are many. Okay, so here I am now in the XFCE desktop, and I launched the wrong terminal and don't know how to use this one. That's okay. I can still launch the one that I know. And I've brought you here partly because I just don't want to, I didn't want this to become just like, hey, you should use Fluxbox because you can do interesting things with it. It goes beyond that. You can do interesting things with XFCE, or, I mean, any desktop. My point being is the modularity, really. So even if we're in this desktop here, we could still run, for instance, Tint 2. As you can see, I mean, it's ugly because I haven't completely gotten rid of this panel at the top. There, now I have. So now we've just got the Tint 2 panel running at the top of my screen, and we can again just use whatever kind of application we so choose. And it didn't inherit the system tray, if you'll notice, and that's again because XFCE started and grabbed control of system tray, and then I started Tint 2, so the system tray was occupied, and then I quit the system tray. So I did things in the wrong order, is all I'm saying. So if you're doing this at home, make sure that you do these things a little bit less haphazard. But then you can see that we've got another XFCE panel down here at the bottom, kind of their standard dock setup, I guess, is what you would call it. So you can mix and match. You're completely free to do that. And that's kind of nice, because once again you maintain the modularity, but you gain all of the modern conveniences of a desktop, like default desktop icons and I don't know, whatever other people like about desktops, I guess. Okay, so having said that this isn't going to be a Fluxbox tutorial, I'm still going to do stuff in Fluxbox. So here I am back in Fluxbox. I'm installing a image thing called Feh, F-E-H, and a thing that gives desktop icons on Fluxbox called iDesk, which I'm not overly fond of, but it may be good for demonstration. While that's installing in the background, I'm going to pop back on over to the tint configuration. I guess go back to black for that, just because that's cool. No rounded borders. We don't like rounded borders. We'll give it a thicker border width. So here I've just set a background image with Fe. That's pretty simple. I don't believe I can use iDesk until there is a configuration file. Well, apparently not. It has a default configuration file, apparently, which is kind of nice. So there, now I've got icons on the desktop with Fluxbox. So that's kind of nice. Now, I haven't actually configured iDesk, so it doesn't do a whole lot of anything yet. What we can do, though, is start Tint 2, see what we've got going on there. I'm also going to install a nice little dock application called Plank. So we've got a workable tint with some customized icon, or customized font, rather, so that's pretty good.
And there you go. Now you've built your own Linux experience. Isn't that fun? Of course it is. This is something that I do on occasion, but in real life, like what ends up happening is that I've got like my one sort of implementation of KDE that I use on a daily basis, and I've got my one implementation of Fluxbox that I use on a daily basis on a different computer. And those are kind of like the two environments that I've built for myself. The KDE one is mostly just KDE, except the way I like it to look and act. And the Fluxbox one is, yeah, it's just Fluxbox with a bunch of different applications that I want to use on top of Fluxbox. So feel free to go as crazy with this as you want. Obviously, it's your environment. You can do whatever you want. If you feel hesitant to experiment, just create yourself a new user and experiment with that guy's environment. And if you like it, you can always copy the config files over your actual user, and suddenly you'll have best of both worlds. So right now, I'm going to go have a great cup of coffee. You should too. We'll come back and we'll talk about GIMP layers for the noobs, and we'll do a My Paint tutorial. I think we're ready for some GIMP now. So this is a question that I get asked a lot. Photoshop and GIMP have two very, very different ways of dealing with layers, or not dealing with layers, interpreting layers. They have different representations of what a layer is. And if you don't understand that those two things are completely different, it can be absolutely maddening. It will drive you crazy. So let me show you how GIMP implements layers, and I think understanding it will help you a lot.
So here's a GIMP file. Let's take this one here. We got a cat, and we've got a screen that looks a little bit blurry. So let's say for whatever reason we want to replace the screen with some other screenshot. So we'll take a photo of the cat to make it really recursive, and I'll copy it, and I'll go back to my original picture. So now, if I paste this clipboard item into my picture in GIMP, we can kind of see how it behaves if we just grab a paintbrush and some really, really unnatural color. And we'll make our paintbrush a little bit larger here so we can see what's going on. I'm painting over this screen just so you can see what's going on. And you see when I hit the border, the boundary of the thing that I have pasted in as a new layer, you see that the paintbrush stops at the edges of the picture. So I've got a perfectly square block of paint now. And the reason for that is because the layer actually only covers the area, the exact area that I pasted in. I'm going to undo that. But you can see this, and most people turn this off, myself included. But if you go to View, Show Layer Boundary, it gives you a yellow and black border around just that layer. Now that can be handy for certain things. For instance, let's say I had wanted to replace the screen with a different screenshot. So instead of a photo, I wanted to do a different screenshot with a different set of applications. And let's say that after I'd scaled it down, I don't know if this will actually work, but let's try it. Let's say that after I scale it down to fit the screen that I need it to fit into, I realize that I've got some dead space, some dead area, and I need to add some content to my layer, to my new layer. Now, in that event, I could, for instance, let's just chop off the top of the screen here. Now, if that were the case, I could, for instance, I don't know, color in this gap with, let's say, a somewhat neutral gray, so that it looks like it's just the desktop peeking through. And then I can go, oops, it's not the right color. And then I can paint in, and you can see that, I mean, I wouldn't obviously go that low, but there's sort of a boundary built in for me that it won't go beyond, which can be handy. I mean, there are obviously lots of use cases for this. It just kind of depends on what you're expecting. The problem arises because a lot of Photoshop users expect, just because this is how Photoshop does it. So if we pretend like this is Photoshop now, if I had, let me get rid of this layer and repaste it in, and I'll show you how it comes in natively in Photoshop. So if I grab this picture again, copy it, and I paste, and I make that a new layer, the thing that Photoshop does automatically is what GIMP calls layer to image size. And you can kind of see, because now that I've got the layer border on, rather than hugging the part that I've pasted in, it extends all the way to the edges. So if we bring back our unnatural pink color and we start painting randomly on our layer, remember on GIMP it stopped at the edge of what we pasted in, and on the Photoshop method it does not stop. It goes all the way to the edges of the screen, because that is natively where the layer itself ends. I haven't used Photoshop in a while, so I don't remember exactly how it behaves in this next situation, but I believe this is different as well. So we've got this gaudy pink layer now. Now in GIMP, if I move it, you can see the borders of the layer. So there's this kind of finite definition of what a layer is, and if I recall correctly on Photoshop, it's basically infinite. It's just a layer is a boundary between the two layers no matter what. So if I were to drag this on Photoshop, if I recall correctly, you'd see the gap there, but it would enforce a layer to image size again, and you could continue painting. Whereas on GIMP, you have to go into layer and tell it layer to image size to get to sort of expand your layer. It's one of those sort of things that it's not really better either way. It's pretty much just actually a complete, you know, it's what you're used to, and it probably differs whether that annoys you or whether you love it, depending on what you're actually doing from one picture to another. Because there have been times where I've been working on something where it's annoying that it does it one way, and then it's, you know, the next day I'll be doing something different, and it's annoying that it does it the other way. So it's really, it's neither good nor bad, it's just important to know the difference. So if you are ever pasting anything from one thing to another, or even, you know, within itself into a picture in GIMP, keep in mind that what you paste is its own layer, and its layer is only as big as the area that you had selected in the first place.
So that's GIMP layering. Now let's look at a different, completely different graphic application called MyPaint. It's a little bit like Krita. I would say, you know, it's kind of, I guess, in spiritually, it's the GNOME version of Krita. I have no idea if it actually has any affiliation with the GNOME developers or anything like that. But it is. It's like the minimalist kind of material emulation program. As I've said before, I'm not a great illustrator, but I have a Wacom tablet and I have my paint, so there's no stopping me. So let's get started.
The default view of my paint is that you don't have any palettes. Everything that you need sort of up front is pretty much at the top of the screen, and that includes color, the different brushes that you've got access to, and customization of those brushes and how they react, including brush size, the opacity, hardness, and the precision with which they follow your brush strokes. So if I have a very steady hand, I might want it to follow every last move. But if I don't, and I don't, and that's why I have this turned up all the way, I might use slow position tracking. So that's sort of from left to right, the palettes: the color palette, the change brush palette, the quick brush settings palette. I keep saying palette, I mean menu really, and the line mode menu. So that's what's easily accessible to you. You've also got the eraser mode, which I usually find easiest to access just with the letter E on your keyboard. You hit E and you enter eraser mode with whatever brush you had set as your eraser most recently. So if you're painting and it doesn't seem like anything's happening, check that your brush mode isn't turned on. I find that to be something that I do very frequently. I'll turn brush on, and if you're on a white palette, certainly erasing white just renders more white, so it doesn't. It gets a little bit annoying. Those are along the top, but I think more often than not I'm using the palettes. So in the very top menu you have things like the brush menu, the color menu, and the layer menu. So the brush menu, you can bring that out into a palette with either Shift B on your keyboard. Or just go to the menu and select Brushes window. Same thing with color, you've got the color window, which is Shift C to show that or hide it. And then finally the layer menu, which you might think would be Shift L, but actually it's not, it's just the letter L. And that is one nice thing about My Paint, is that a lot of the keyboard shortcuts are single letters, so it's not like you have to twist your fingers around to do control this and control that and alt this and alt that. It's just one touch, and whatever you want happens. So here, as you can see, as I'm sort of writing out shortcuts, it's a good demonstration of what slow and fast tracking brings you. So whenever I write something with fast tracking turned on, it gets every little move, so it's easy to make, for instance, familiar alphabetic letters. Whereas if I turn on slow tracking, But then suddenly the ability to do subtle things takes a little bit of a back seat to just making sure that the line appears really smooth, which is kind of nice. But it also it depends on what you're looking for as well. Navigating around your canvas is a left click, so if you've got a Wacom tablet, that's just a press down on your pins button. But if not, you can do it with the mouse. No, you can't. That would be middle click on the mouse, sorry. So it's middle click, because a left click on a Wacom tablet really is pressing down on your tablet. That's the left click. So middle click to kind of just scroll around your canvas, and you can do that easily and quickly. But you also have kind of cool, again, just along the top of the mini bar in MyPaint, you've got quick buttons for not only for moving around, but also even rotating, which is kind of nice. So that if you're trying to color at some kind of odd angle, and you're finding it hard to do that on your tablet, you can rotate your canvas on screen, do whatever you need to, and then rotate it back. So there's all kinds of repositioning and zooming along the top as well, and a couple of other tools which I'll get to eventually, but not yet. Okay, so let's do something here. So we'll go into our change brush menu and grab something somewhat soft but not too soft. Let's try this one. That looks interesting. So I'm just selecting a brush, and I'll make it fairly large. And then I, as you can probably tell if you're looking at the video, and if not, I'll just tell you about it. The color palette is a lot more versatile, I would say, than the change color menu, and that's one reason why I prefer to use the color palette, because you get lots of different views. You get the color wheel view, you get a color swatch view, you get the sort of traditional kind of GIMP color picker, lots of different things. So I'm going to keep it simple for now and just kind of use whatever they give me on the palette, so that I don't have to sit here and mess around with color shades. Oh, that's not what I expected it to do. Okay, so let me change to a different. That's pretty dark. How's that? That's textured. Okay, so as you can see, there are lots of different brush styles in MyPaint, and it's I would say it's pretty much equal to Krita in terms of the variety that it offers you. The different brush sets available from the brush palette are really fun to play with as well, because they're not just like brush tips. They're actually like completely different sort of settings that goes way beyond just the what they produce. Sort of when you press down, it's more about what it's kind of trying to suggest as I guess emulation. So the one that I'm using right now, for people who aren't watching the video, kind of starts out really really soft and not very opaque, and then the more you keep painting, the darker and thicker your coating becomes. So that's kind of nice if you're looking for, I don't know, a little bit more of a textured paint rather than sort of fill this area with one color. It gives you a lot more texture, which is nice. I'm trying to kind of white out some of the stuff that I did earlier as I was just playing around. And I like to keep, personally, I think mistakes on the canvas look really good. And I don't mean keeping the mistakes themselves, but I do mean, like, rather than just erasing, do what you would do if you were painting and just kind of, like, draw over that area or paint over that area. And it kind of, I don't know, I find it gives it really interesting textures, although certainly if you're a professional illustrator, you're probably not really looking for that. But that's what I do anyway. Okay, so we've got a blue splotch there, and we can double-click on the layer in the layer palette and name it something. We'll call it Sky, or Kai, since I accidentally missed the S there. There we go. Sky. And then, as usual, you can add a new layer, and it adds a new layer, and unlike GIMP, which I just showed you, where it kind of shows you a layer that is sort of embedded in a larger canvas, these layers are complete. It's basically another canvas laid over this canvas, but you can paint on this canvas and still see the one below it. So it's an infinite layer. There's no boundary to a layer, just as there's no boundary to your canvas. Okay, so let's get a different brush here. As you can see if you're watching the video, there are different brush styles, lots of different styles, and you can get a lot more than this. People publish brush sets all the time after they've completed work. A lot of times the open source deliverable, as it were, ends up being the brush set that they used, which is kind of nice. Okay, so let me just do some quick line art here, just to get a quick sketch down. And I'm probably using a really bad tool for sketching, because it's pretty dark actually, but that's okay, I can fix that later. This is probably more of an ink over pen, but that's okay. So this is just a rough sketch, and I'm not actually drawing as fast as it looks like I'm drawing. That's just for video's sake, so that you don't have to sit there and watch me sketch really badly. Okay, so that's the good parts. Now let's make a new layer, and we'll call this color. And that layer probably doesn't want to be on top of the line art. It probably wants to be under the line art, so I can color into the lines. And now I'll choose, I don't know, maybe something a little bit less harsh, something a little bit softer. Maybe a brush, but nothing too crazy. How about this one? Okay, so I'm choosing a brush from my color palette. And I'll probably need a slightly larger radius. Yeah, that's good. Okay, so that might be too much, actually. Let me knock that down a bit. So I'm just using the menus and the palettes kind of in conjunction to adjust my settings. And I like to just kind of test off to the side. And then I'll color this little character that I'm drawing in. So I've got three layers now. I've got the sky, which is the background. I've got the line art, and I've got in between those, I've got the coloring. So I'm just kind of quickly coloring this character in. Okay, there we go. So there's some shade. So what we'll do now is we'll go back up to the sketch layer and we'll knock its opacity down a bit. And that's just so that when we do our final, our lines over the completed work, we'll still have the guide, but we won't be distracted too much. I'll go into turbo mode again for this, so that you don't have to sit here and watch me. It's always, I think, difficult, at least for me, because I'm not a professional illustrator at all. I'm barely an illustrator at all. To find the right pen for the inking step. But I think, as you can see, as I'm drawing kind of along this screen, you know, the harder I press and the slower I move on the Wacom tablet, the thicker the line. And then if I kind of lightly and quickly sketch, you get the thinner line. So it really does. I mean, it looks exactly pretty much like an ink pen, or maybe even a calligraphy brush. So that's a pretty good start, I think, for the inking. I find a lot of times, I guess, that the inking process, at least the way I do it, which I'm sure is probably the wrong way to do it, tends to kind of diminish a lot of the other things that I've that I had kind of gotten used to during the sketching phase. So I usually have to go back and do sort of additional coloring to get back like what I thought I had, and then abolished. And of course, I mean, using negative space is usually pretty good too. In other words, doing a little bit of erasing is usually probably a good idea. But yeah, that's the idea anyway. Now, somewhere in here, of course, we have all these random sketches here off the side, like all the pen tests. And I did say that I liked to leave mistakes in the final product, but not quite to that degree. That's a little bit extreme. So I'll get rid of those with the eraser tool. Oops. And it looks like I don't know where I... Yeah, right there. So the layer thing with my paint, as with anything, you know, where you have layers, it can get a little bit messy, because especially if you're testing your brushes and stuff, and then you realize later, oh, I need to get rid of all those weird little test strokes that I did. How can I get rid of those? Now, it's worth noticing, before I continue that thought, it's worth mentioning, rather, that rotation of your canvas isn't actually rotating the canvas, it's just the view of your canvas. So don't think that when you export this image, just because I've rotated it 45 degrees, it's going to actually export at 45 degrees. That would be something I would have to do elsewhere. Speaking of negative space, I am, now that I've zoomed in a little bit more, I'm seeing a lot more sort of coloring outside the lines than I had prepared to admit to, so I'll get rid of those. But anyway, as I was saying about the layers and how they get a little bit confusing and potentially dangerous, because you sit there and test all your brush strokes and then realize, oh yeah, I've got like a billion random brush marks all over the place that I now need to get rid of. There is a very good tool to fix that very issue, and that is the sketchpad, or scratchpad. So if you open a scratchpad window, you can test whatever brush you happen to be using on any layer in your sketchpad. And it's the rules for the sketchpad apply exactly as they apply in my paint itself. So yeah, use it freely if you want to avoid problems like I've just demonstrated. Don't mark up your canvas, mark up your sketchpad. And sketchpads, I just accidentally clicked the save button, didn't mean to, but you can save sketches, you can clean them, you can get new ones, you know, so it's a nice little feature. I just don't ever bother using it myself, but you should. So that's the scratch pad. Okay, so once you're sort of finished, and we'll just call this finished, then you probably want to export your final product. I don't, but let's say that you did. So there's this really nice frame tool up at the top menu bar, and it's brings up this frame palette of sorts, and you can select the layer, I select the biggest layer, and then crop to the current layer. That tends to work pretty well for me. And so that basically zeroes in the exportable area. So if I was to go to File, Export, then since my frame is enabled, it will only export the area that the frame can see. And I could, if maybe that's more than I need, as long as the frame is active and turned on, then I can adjust the frame size to where I actually want it to be. And then that's the area that will export. And of course, I mean, if I don't maybe I don't want the whole thing, maybe I just want like the character that I've drawn for some reason, then I could do that. So I find that to be a very helpful tool, because I'm very unfocused when I'm on the one or two occasions that I have to actually use my paint. It's more of like a bunch of sketching until something turns out good, and then you can just kind of draw a frame around that and export it, and you don't have to worry about sort of the fact that you have like this infinite canvas which may have been filled with sketches that you don't want to keep at all. The weird thing about the frame is that when you first bring it up, at least when I first bring it up, it often comes on as not enabled. So you could set a frame to some dimension, and then you think, okay, well, how do I get my frame? What do I do? And you can't, like, your inclination is to select something, but it's not selectable. What you do is you hit enabled, or if you click, like I say, if you're on a layer that has a size, then you can enable it and crop it to that current layer, and then you'll see it, but because that toggles the enabled on automatically. But that's the frame. That's a handy one. The other tools on the toolbar I don't really use enough to tell you much about. I mean, the eyedropper is the eyedropper. I don't know what the next one is. And then there's a mirror tool, which I'm sure is very useful for portrait work and stuff like that, but I've never used that myself, so I won't even pretend to know how to advise you on using that. But that's my paint, pretty much. There are lots of brushes out there. You can download them from people who are really good at this stuff. I didn't even go into the brush customization, but there's a lot of different kinds of stroke types that you can do. So you've got the freehand, which is what I was using this entire time. You've got lines, which draw, as you would expect, lines, straight lines. And then there's segmented lines. So that's kind of a click and sort of a connect the dots kind of line. And then an ellipsis. So that draws a circle. And again, all that is subject to whatever brush you are using and what it's set to do in terms of how it looks. And then, as you can see, there's a whole pressure thing where you can increase the fall off and the build up and all kinds of different things. I keep mine at the default because I'm not that fancy. But that's how you design your own brushes, pretty much, is mess around with the line modes. And eventually you can build your own palette of brushes and even publish them to the internet at some point if you want other people to start using them, which could be kind of cool.
So there you go. That's my paint. There's a lot you can do with my paint. It's a fantastic application, as you could probably see. You should definitely play around with it. I've gotten a request for a simple paint program, something very simple, not fancy like my painter Krita, not complex like GIMP. So maybe at some point in the future I will also review one of the really, really drop dead simple paint programs out there. There are a couple out there. I think one is called Pinta, P-I-N-T-A. Another one I think is, well, Tux Paint, I guess. MT Paint is another one. There's a couple out there, so maybe I'll show one or two in the future. But for now, you have my paint, and I think we've reached the end of this episode. So thanks for listening or watching, and I will see you in 2 weeks.
that's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can find me online at gnuworldorder.info or slackermedia.info. You can contact me via Jabber at notklaatu@jabber.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as notklaatu. I'm on the Freenode network in the channels Oddcast Planet, Dev Random, Slacker Media, Slackware, any of those will do. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.
His hands were dirty, and his hair was messy.